Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Tammy Gaw. Tammy is an attorney, athletic trainer, and advocate who has been a part of the sports landscape for over 20 years. And she has quite a varied career path, and I'm excited to talk with her about it. So it's good to have you here with us today, Tammy, to talk a little bit about your career, as well as to get caught up on the historical basketball league. So to start off, can you just give us a brief introduction, talk to us about what you're doing now and how you got there?
Well, first off, thank you very much for having me. I'm glad our schedules have finally worked out to make it happen. I know we've been trying to do this for a while. You are definitely correct about a nonlinear career. I started off my career in sports medicine before becoming an attorney. And even my career in law has been pretty unconventional. I graduated and passed the bar right as the recession was kicking off. So that was a lot of fun. Saw the same job-related chaos that a lot of other people did. And ended up working as in-house counsel in the foreign policy space for a while before coming back to sports and combining my medical and legal background. But my undergraduate is in sports sciences from the University of Oklahoma. I have a master's in sports management, and then I did my law degree out at Loyola of Los Angeles, and then came to D.C. Just about 11 years ago. So now I work fairly exclusively in the sports law and sports advocacy space.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, like I said, and we've alluded to a little bit here, you have a pretty distinct nonlinear bio. So you do legal work now. Was that always the plan, or were you, you know, planning on focusing on athletic training and other things that you were doing earlier on?
I don't actually recall wanting to be a lawyer growing up. Although at one of my high school reunions, I was reminded that apparently a guidance counselor had recommended it before I went to school. I don't recall that at all. But I think the same thing that kept me in medicine or that started me in medicine and then kind of followed me into law is the advocacy part, which is why at Advantage Rule, the catchphrase is attorney, athletic trainer, an advocate, which I love an alliteration, but I think it really sums it up as well. So I started the Advantage Rule in 2012, mostly to act as an umbrella for all of my interests and career elements. It's the umbrella under which I do my writing. I've done books, I'm writing a curriculum, that kind of thing, speaking, and then I do my consulting through it. So I don't know that I think the only thing that I knew I wanted to be somehow was an entrepreneur, and somehow that navigated itself through the legal space. So I don't think I actually did always want to be a lawyer, but I wouldn't have it any other way. I think there's only seven of us that we know of that are board certified both as athletic trainers and also licensed as attorneys. So it's a small group.
Okay, yeah, you're very special, I guess we could say. You know, I think those two things don't strike a lot of people as being very similar. Do you think it's the same kind of skill sets that go into both athletic training and being a lawyer, or have you kind of done pretty different things in your times in both those spheres?
I think my attention to detail has proven helpful in both of those. My memory, recollection, that kind of thing, because we in medicine, you need to. You need to be able to remember a variety of different things. There's an awful lot to keep in mind there.
Okay. Well, yeah. No, obviously that's important no matter what you do. So, and so now, you know, like you say, you're wearing these different hats. You have your own Advantage Rule, which is kind of your base that you use to do everything that you're doing. You know, as we've, you know, found out trying to even schedule this podcast, you're pretty busy. So how do you find balance in everything you have going on?
Well, I'm not sure that you can call anything in my life balanced. I'm sure some people who know me listening to this will have a little chuckle about that. But I think having sort of an entrepreneurial mindset anywhere means having a lot of different ideas and initiatives in play at once. So my schedule can look pretty chaotic. I wouldn't have it any other way, but it's a juggling act. But last year I became a certified yoga instructor. That's helped a lot. There are running jokes that if I can't make it in the studio or onto my mat, people are going to pay dearly. I try not to say that, but that gives me the mental balance of it, and then just having great control over my calendar does the other half. And then I travel as much as I can, never as much as I'd like. But that was part of the reason that I formed Advantage Rule, was to have that flexibility over my schedule in life. So.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, that's all very interesting. So let's turn now and talk about the Historical Basketball League. People who've subscribed to this podcast should be familiar with it. About a year ago, I spoke with your colleague Ricky Vellante about the Historical Basketball League, which is a proposal to establish a league for college athletes where they can be compensated above what's currently allowed by NCAA regulations. And just to give a brief recap, it would be a separate league that's not governed by the NCAA at all. And when I last spoke with Ricky, the idea of the HBL was still in its infancy. So can you give us some updates about what's going on and what's the current status of the league?
I can give you a few. There, it looks like the league will launch in June of 2020. So that's going to be really exciting. I'm on the board of the league, and I joined that because of the idea of the way that medicine was going to be overseen in this new league. So I can tell you that there's been excellent progress. Ricky and the team that actually are doing the hands-on work are making great progress, and there's going to be some announcements made very soon. Obviously, it's a challenge. Interesting, sometimes frustrating to explain how amateurism is a fraud when it's the only way that the U.S. has ever known. But listeners should definitely keep an eye on this space and check out the Historical Basketball League, because there's going to be some really, really interesting things coming down the pipe really soon.
Yeah, no, and I know the league has a pretty good website that they're good at getting the word out whenever there is a press release or something exciting happening. So people can check that out to stay up to date, or follow you on Twitter, follow any of these people. There's a lot of stuff going on there. So.
Yes, it's an interesting time.
So, as you said, your specialty here is kind of the medical aspect of this league. So that's what we'd like to talk about today, is how the HBL would approach healthcare and how this distinguishes it from other forms of college sports, most importantly, the NCAA's current structure. And so kind of how that separates itself. So could you give us a little description of the proposals for providing healthcare that the HBL has?
Absolutely. And it's actually really simple. The key is that it treats these athletic students like employees. I have obviously the utmost respect for the athletic trainers that work at all levels. And I have been and spent a lot of time with ones that still work at the university level, and many of them feel hamstrung, as I did, about the restrictions in how medicine can be accessed, and the access to that kind of treatment can be accessed by kids that are done with their college careers. Just to give a little bit of context, I started my sports medicine career, as I said, as an athletic trainer at OU. And we would see former athletes come in to try and get seen by the team doctors for injuries that had related to injuries that they'd sustained while playing. One of the examples I used is, if you tear an ACL in college, you can have an ACL repair and return to play and, potentially finish out your playing career at the college level. It's not nearly the career-ending sentence that it used to be in the past. But what'll happen with that kind of injury and others is 6-7 years down the line, you might start getting a meniscus issue come up. And understand, in the mid-90s, this is, a decade plus before the Affordable Care Act. So pre-existing conditions, insurance companies could actually deny coverage for what they considered pre-existing conditions. And when you're talking about, on your record, you have an ACL repair, they consider a meniscus repair often to be pre-existing, or an element of this pre-existing ACL injury. And that used to really frustrate me. Because even before I really had my head around what, quote, amateurism at the college level, you know, really honestly looks like in practice. It just didn't seem right that athletes who were there performing for the university, making the university millions of dollars, as soon as they were done, whether the injury ended their career or their college career ended by means of the 5 years, the university washed their hands of them. And there was no responsibility to take care of anything that had come up. And I know that frustrated a lot of athletic trainers, because you see these young men and women who you spend 60, 70, 80 hour weeks with sometimes, and you become very attached to them and you become very attached to their health. And it's difficult to see that play out. And so in the mid, you know, to late 90s, I was whiteboarding. We used to joke that my office looked like a murder wall because I had all of this stuff drawn all over, trying to figure out how it was that we could create a health insurance program that would cover these athletes for injuries and secondary conditions that developed as a result of those injuries. When I went to law school, obviously anyone who has gone to law school knows that scheduling, as much as I said earlier about my control over my schedule, that did not apply to my first year of law school. So I would, I kind of shelved it for a little bit. And when I came out in 2007, you know, as we moved a couple of years past that, the Affordable Care Act started coming into play. And so pre-existing conditions, while insurance companies could charge you a lot for them, they couldn't deny coverage for it in practice. So that was somewhat helpful. So I still kept working on it, and I kept discussing it, and sometimes it would come up in speeches and on panels and things like that. But the last couple of years, when it became clear that certain elements of our healthcare system were going to be under attack as far as coverage went, I dusted that back off and started working on it again. So with that context, when I first heard about the Historical Basketball League, I actually called Ricky up and just said, hey, who do you have overseeing what this medical situation is going to look like? And I asked him some questions, and he gave me some answers, and I went ahead and came on board. Because I really feel like what they're doing treats the athletes as whole people, both that they are putting their bodies on the line and deserve to be compensated for it. Their names are attracting attention and money and sponsors, and they deserve to be compensated for it. And that they are just like any other employee, that workers' compensation needs to be able to be in play. So that's the reason that the healthcare proposal, it's a small element of what the HBL is offering, but it's extraordinarily valuable one. And I think it's something I'm very excited to see happen.
Okay. So to make sure I understand, the way that current college athletes, their healthcare is dealt with is, you know, if they suffer some kind of injury, an ACL tear, on the field or on the court of play, the college currently has some kind of insurance set up to help cover them while they're playing or while they're attending school. But then after they leave, they're no longer covered, and any ongoing problems that stem from that are kind of their problem. And you know, in the case of in some cases, if it's a pre-existing condition, potentially they couldn't even get any kind of coverage for it because their coverage through the university expired once they left. Is that correct?
That's pretty much right. There's been some extension, some adjustment to the NCAA rules about, you know, coverage 1 to 2 years after an athlete leaves. But if you're talking about anyone who's ever torn a rotator cuff, knows that that's you're not going to only experience problems, you know, a year or two after that. So yeah, that's pretty much it. And it's not that the healthcare is the problem. The athletic trainers that work at the university level are some of the best in the business. They are extraordinary at what they deal with, and how they deal with it. The professionalism and the education that we have to have. I always start off that I'm in sports medicine because it's easier to explain why I'm not a doctor than explain why I'm not a personal trainer. but, you know, athletic trainers have all of the ability to provide this service and this treatment to athletes but it's the access that's the problem. So it's, like you said, the kids get done, and I use the word kids not pejoratively at all. It's a, it's an affectionate term that I just can't seem to get to stop using. But yeah, it's about coming back and being able to actually access that treatment that they deserve.
Okay, and then you had also mentioned, you know, this was a big problem before the Affordable Care Act. I guess now that the Affordable Care Act is law, you know, somebody might say, well, this isn't an issue anymore because now the pre-existing condition thing, you know, an insurance company can't not provide coverage for these things just because it's a pre-existing condition. So because people are required to have some kind of coverage and they have the opportunity to get coverage, whether it's through a future private employer or you know, the Obamacare marketplace or something like that, they, you know, they have the opportunity to be covered anyway, so it shouldn't be the college's responsibility to pay for ongoing coverage there. Is there a reason why that's not satisfactory by itself?
Yes, because that's not entirely correct, is what okay. I would tell them. Sometimes I tell them it differently, but using different words. But first, you know, if you keep an eye on what's coming out of the Congress right now, they're going after pre-existing conditions. That is one of the things on the chopping block that they want to return back to the old days, if you will. And so that's the pre-existing conditions, I would argue, are nowhere near safe. And then on top of that, just because they have to cover it now doesn't mean that they don't charge you through the roof for it. So in my mind, there's not as much difference as people like to claim there is between an insurance company blatantly not covering an injury because of they deem it to be a pre-existing condition and them making it so unaffordable that it's essentially impossible to get the coverage for it. You're, even in the marketplace, if you have a history of low back pain, for instance, that is an entire case of red flags for insurance companies, and they will jack your premiums up just through the roof. So what I would say to that is that that entire argument is sort of based on the fallacy of so it's essentially based in the backwards system that masquerades as healthcare in the United States. So, I mean, I travel a lot, you know, a lot of my inner circle is from other countries, and the way that we have an insurance system here as opposed to healthcare and can literally deny people coverage is anathema to some of them. They don't understand how that could possibly be. So part of the problem, if we went to a system where there was some sort of nationalized health service, this wouldn't be a problem at all because nobody could be denied and it wouldn't be, you couldn't be denied in practice and you couldn't be denied because you couldn't afford an $800 a month premium that barely covered what you needed to get done. So okay. That's, as long as we're stuck where we are now, then the athletic students that are doing this work and making all this money for the universities need to be treated as employees. And that's one of the great things that the HBL does.
Okay. So the like you say, the HBL, the plan is to treat them as employees and to provide the coverage that any employer would typically provide employees. And so, you know, that's above and beyond what's currently being done in college athletics. So I guess now, again, this the same person who's peppering you with questions, trying to find flaws in this plan, you know, they might say, well, you know, healthcare is expensive. And if you're, especially if you're providing, you know, workers' comp and insurance down the line for future problems and stuff like that, you know, that's going to be expensive. And you know, the HBL is this new upstart league, you know, how are they going to be able to pay for that?
The same way any other business would. Upstart businesses all the time that have to provide insurance have to provide, you know, workers' comp insurance as well. That's part of what has made this whole thing so frustrating with the ongoing battle in and around the NCAA and their refusal to treat athletes like the employees that they are for term for the purposes of health coverage, because it wouldn't be that expensive to set it up. I mean, yes, obviously at the level, you know, the breadth and scope of the NCAA, that's not going to be a cheap bill, but it's not it's not that preclusive to carry a premium for athletes within your system, and the HBL is going to have no problem. I was very pleased to hear that that was one of the things that they basically made the call on at the infancy of the planning for the HBL, is that, of course, their employees were going to treat them as such. So it's not, my answer to that lovely person who was peppering me with questions would be to take a look at what startup costs for any small business would be like, and this is not going to be much different.
Okay, and, you know, I know the HBL has some people on board who are economists and things like that. Have actual, you know, analyses been run in respect of this, or the view is that it's just clearly, you know, a typical startup cost that would be manageable?
Oh, no, the analysis have absolutely been run. I got a chance to meet at the Sports Lawyers Association. I got to meet one of the gentlemen who's involved with actually providing the insurance. And I was the vice president of the organizing committee for the World Police and Fire Games in 2015, and that's a $20 million event that you have to carry huge amounts of liability and different kinds of policies. So I worked very closely with our insurance people, and it's just really not that difficult. It just requires wanting to make the decision to do it. The data is already there because it's done all of the time, and the costs are just not that. They're just not that oppressive at all.
Okay. And, you know, you spoke about potential political changes, you know, the potential removal of the protections against prohibitions on coverage for pre-existing conditions. Would any of these, you know, this potential uncertainty about the future of the Affordable Care Act and coverage provided thereunder, would that affect how the HBL would provide coverage for athletes at all?
Not for the purposes of workers' compensation. Workers' compensation insurance predated the Affordable Care Act, and it will, until nationalized healthcare, it will live on well past the current stages of the Affordable Care Act. So, I mean, that's where the real hurdle comes in explaining to people, because we're used to thinking of how we treat athletic students at college level. We're used to thinking of that in terms of personal insurance, because larger schools can have an insurance policy that covers everyone. Smaller schools, I worked at a smaller university, still Division I, but not the scale of OU, out in California. And they had the students' insurance was primary, and then they had a secondary policy that covered everything else. So it wasn't, there was never any out-of-pocket expense for any of the treatment that happened. It just required some billing gymnastics of having to bill two different insurances to get the entire amount paid. But that's the way that we are so accustomed to thinking of college sports, because they're, quote, amateurs and they're not employees. But when you think of it in terms of employees at any company, at the restaurant, you know, workers' compensators, if you slip and fall at the, you know, dive bar on the corner by my house, that insurance is not, you know, that's not millions and millions and millions of dollars. That's just as an employee, because frequently the amount that you pay in premiums is not met on the back end by the costs of most of these injuries. And you have top-notch athletes that are going to be working with these teams. You know, you have essentially in-house medical care. So it's, you know, it's the best of both worlds, but that's been the hurdle of explaining that the conventional way of looking at how medicine is paid for, as it were, at the college level now, versus if those athletes were treated as employees, is night and day.
Okay, yeah, and again, I'm by no means a healthcare expert at all. I'm just trying to imagine, you know, again, this person peppering you with questions, they might say, well, you know, the slip and fall insurance, workers' comp that, you know, a law firm might have, yeah, the premiums that are being paid are, you know, going to be sufficient to cover any slip and fall problems that might happen, because being a lawyer isn't inherently physically dangerous, right? You're
sure,
sitting in an office or something. Whereas in athletics, you know, basketball is a, you know, an aggressive sport. People are bumping into each other and stuff, and maybe these athletes are kind of assuming the risk, and it's unfair to place that on the university or the league or whatever, that, you know, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I say, again, it goes back to the idea that somehow number crunching insurance executives should have anything to say about what treatment anyone should get. You know, this is, you're right about the, you know, a law firm slip and fall is not a comparable activity level, but the guys at the local construction store carrying huge amounts of pallets and things like that, that's not an obtrusive level of premium cost and things like that. And, you know, it just, when you get down to it, like I said, the in-house treatment that athletic trainers provide, and obviously I'm biased, but I'm also right, is a cost benefit and a cost management element in and of itself. Because what would need to be, you know, filed down and gotten approval for all of these different CPT codes and this kind of treatment and that kind of treatment can happen in-house in an athletic trainer. You can get an immediate consultation with the team doctor. So you have these things that are immediately going. So it's actually, in the grand scheme of things, makes it less expensive because you're not having to jump through all of these hoops created by the number crunching, bean counting insurance executives that seem to somehow think they know anything about how and when medicine should be dispensed.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, that's an interesting point to raise, that there is a system in place that's set up to be, you know, efficient for these athletes already.
Absolutely. And
yeah. Okay. So yeah, no, it's really interesting. Like I said at the beginning, you know, this is something I had never even thought about. You know, either the current setup or, you know, the HBL's plan. And so I think that's going to be something that a lot of people have not thought of, and a lot of people are going to be interested in, as kind of an interesting tweak to college athletics. So I know we're getting close to wrapping up here. So is there anything else on the subject or anything else you want to say before we get out of here?
No, I like it. You know, I'm always a fan when we can go toe to toe and ask the tough questions, because I think this is something that's well past the time and being addressed. So, yeah, I would say that I encourage people to take a look. You know, contact me if you have any questions. Definitely follow the HBL. Ricky Vellante is doing just yeoman's effort. I'm so impressed with the approach and the way that they're going about doing this. The transparency that they're going about with it. I'm really excited. So, yeah, anybody can ask me any questions they want, or just take a breath and look at the way healthcare is done in this country just a little bit differently. If I could get everybody to do that, I would consider it a pretty successful day.
Well, yeah, no, and you know, that's a different podcast than this. If you want to talk about the whole structure of healthcare, and I don't know if we're going to be able to solve that in 30 minutes, but
lots of fun conversations at cocktail parties for that one.
Yeah. So, but no, yeah, I mean, Tammy is very accessible. So definitely, you know, your contact information will be in the show notes here. So, you know, if people want to reach out to you, they'll certainly be able to find you. So
great.
So yeah, so no, thanks for coming on the Sports Law Biz podcast. I think it's been great, and we'll continue the discussion offline.
Great, thanks so much.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIBMontoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott. And you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle @PeterJOTT. through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle @SportsLawBiz or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.